Question for the U.S. President from the People's Republic of China. What's your catchphrase?
During the Clinton administration, U.S.-China relationship were characterized in Clinton's words, strategic, constructive partnership. During the Bush era, it was, quote-unquote, stakeholder. Have you come up with a catchphrase of your own?
Television's most exciting new game, catchphrase.
I'm terrible with those little catchphrases and sound bites. So I haven't come up with anything catchy yet, but if you have any suggestions, let me know. I'll be happy to use them.
How about welcome to Chimerica? Obama bobs weaving the U.S.-China relationship at the G20. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It is Friday, April the 3rd. I'm Femi Okay. Adora Udoji is spending time with her new baby. Coming up this hour, we'll discuss the unemployment figures for March, which will be released in about half an hour from now. We'll also talk about what the deployment of more American troops to Afghanistan means for that country's civilians. And we'll preview the Final Four in college basketball, which takes place this weekend. Those stories coming up, but first, headlines.
President Obama is in France this morning, where he met with French President Nicolas Sarkozy. The president is calling for strong alliances, both with France and all members of NATO.
One of my messages to our NATO allies is going to be the more capability we see here in Europe, the happier the United States will be, the more effective we will be in coordinating our activities.
Meanwhile, the French president says France will accept one prisoner from Guantanamo Bay prison camp, and it would facilitate its closing. Next up for President Obama is a quick trip across the Rhine, where he'll meet with German Chancellor Angela Merkel. The meetings come ahead of the NATO summit, which begins tonight. Femi?
All of those leaders are coming straight from the G20 in London. World leaders decided to create a program that will regulate banks and hedge funds more closely. They also pledged $1.1 trillion in loans to poor countries. Here in the U.S., the House and Senate both approved drafts of the president's 2010 budget, but it's just one step. Tougher battles are expected as lawmakers work out details. The former Illinois governor, Rod Blagojevich, has been indicted on federal corruption charges. His successor, Illinois Governor Pat Quinn, says that the indictment is necessary in order to avoid future scandals.
I think today, more than ever, I'm committed to making sure our government has fundamental reform from top to bottom. We need to overhaul Illinois government to make sure that everything is done right for the people.
The charges come 2 months after Blagojevich was impeached and removed from office. John.
Jobs numbers in the next half hour expected to be unemployment expected to rise. The S&P begins trading at 8:34 this morning, a flat opening expected on Wall Street. All right, we're doing a little experiment on The Takeaway. We want to know about the Takeaway community. Everyone knows where we are. We're in a studio here in New York City, but where are you? We want to sort of update everyone's status somehow, kind of like Twitter. 877-8-MY-TAKE. All you have to do is tell us your name, where you are, what you're doing. Are you in the kitchen? Are you in the car?
What you're wearing?
Workplace. It can be mundane. It can be insane. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Update yourself in the Takeaway community.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. Responsibilityproject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
So, good morning. Update your status in the Takeaway community, all right? Call 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Tell us exactly what you're doing, where you are. Give us your name. We'll give you more information in just a moment. We do a lot of numbers on this program. In a half hour, the March unemployment figures will be out. But the faces and voices behind those numbers are more important. As far as unemployment is concerned, the length of time, the challenges of people dealing with employment problems in a weak economy, all very human questions. And here to talk about them, John Fox joins us from Taylorsville, North Carolina, where he's a construction worker. John, how are you doing this morning?
Fine, thank you.
Great. Dan Gross, senior editor at Newsweek, columnist for Slate, is in Washington, D.C. to help give us some context here. Dan, thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
And from right here in New York City up in Harlem, Janet joins us. She just wants to use her first name. Janet, how are you doing?
I'm good, thanks. Good morning.
Great. John, let me begin with you. How long have you been out of work?
13 months.
13 months. Now, you know, I can imagine a month, I can imagine two or three, but 13 months, I mean, what's your strategy right now? And how are you going to begin the day with the idea that you have 13 months of unemployment behind you?
Well, basically, I just start every day thanking God that I'm able to get up and able to go out and try to find something.
Are you still on unemployment, John, or has that run out yet?
No, it's narrowing down, which I was unable to draw it till actually I had worked a couple part-time jobs, temporary positions, and made enough just to make enough. It basically just buys a few groceries, and that's about it.
Now, you're a construction worker. We all understand that the housing crisis has dire implications for people in construction. Are you looking at jobs outside of your normal industry?
Yes, I initially, when our project closed down, I came back to North Carolina and started looking for, figured, well, it wouldn't be any problem to find a construction project or a construction job at another company or something of that nature. But lo and behold, I found out that there was nothing available and nobody spending any money. And to go outside my, field of construction management, I found to be closed doors everywhere I turn.
So what have you tried for? What have you tried for, John?
Well, pretty much any type of job. I was basically looking for some sort of supervision or management positions, and then after no luck with that, I just started looking for basically anything that was available. And where I live at in the region down here in western North Carolina, manufacturing has been what's been the most popular thing in this part of the country, and there's not even no manufacturing work. I've never really worked manufacturing, so it makes me really unqualified for anything that they have around here. So I find myself unqualified for anything since the construction business is upside down.
Well, John, it gets me steamed to hear people who've been out of work claiming that they're unqualified. We ought to all be able to find something that we're qualified for, and the employment market should help to do that. Hold on there a second. I want to ask Janet a question. You have managed to find your way back to the workforce, Janet. How tough was that?
It's been quite a journey. It was a rough year. But while I was unemployed, I basically went to Temp Positions, which is a reputable temp agency here in New York City, and I had a great meeting with their placement manager, and she just, I think before the end of the day, before I even got back home that day after interviewing with her, she had already called me with an opportunity, and I basically told her, I was like, I'll do anything. I'm up floors. I don't care what I have to do, but place me somewhere, and I'll take it from there.
Now, you don't want to use your last name because you're concerned that you actually might do something to cause this job to go away, right?
Well, people know where I'm working now, and I'm not allowed to represent where I'm working now.
Right.
You know, we have policies against that. And I'm in human resources, so it was just a matter of not breaking the policy.
No, that's fine. That's totally fine. So, Dan Gross, first of all, the unemployment statistics are a raw number. It was 8.1% in February. It's expected to be worse in March. But behind those numbers, how does the Labor Department track the experience of, say, John Fox, 13 months going from supervisory to I'll take anything to I'm unqualified for manufacturing, and, you know, Janet's situation where she feels, okay, maybe she has a job, but it's precarious. Anything could happen.
Well, they do measure things like, you know, the amount of long-term unemployment, people who are working part-time but, you know, would really like to be working full-time, and, you know, all those numbers, as well as the headline number, are at, you know, levels we haven't seen in basically a generation. But they don't do the best job of, you know, it's very difficult to capture this kind of sense of frustration of people, you know, taking sort of whatever job is available or, you know, feeling like they have to switch industries entirely. And we always talk about our economy as being this really dynamic thing where industries are constantly rising and falling and labor is mobile and flexible. And in the aggregate, you know, that's true over time. It's just that when you're dealing on the individual level, and you could put yourself in any of these shoes because we work in industries that are going through these types of change, if my publication ceased to exist, you know, it would take me a long time before I said to myself, I'm going to move to another part of the country. I'm going to try to get out of this industry. You know, we're all good at what we do and are reluctant to kind of just switch wholesale in search of employment.
John, this is Femi here. When we're looking at the unemployment statistics, there's also a lot of conversation about this is an opportunity. This is an opportunity maybe to reinvent yourself. Do you feel that every week when the new stats come out and you're still actually looking for work?
Well, I keep hope that it will be a way to reinvent myself. Even considered the possibilities of going back to school, but being out of work so long now has kind of made it impossible to even fund that venture. But I don't know, with the economy the way it is right where we live, all the manufacturing is disappearing, all the other type of industries are disappearing. Of course, where we live in this area, the major banks are having their issues as well.
Sure.
Around the Charlotte area and the Hickory area and everywhere up in here, it's just really devastating, the numbers that are on the downhill side with the employment. So,
well, you're up in double digits there in Taylorsville, North Carolina. John and Janet, let me ask you one quick question, and then we'll get a final word from Dan Gross. You had dreams and ideas about what you'd be doing, say, 2-3 years from now. Both of you, have those totally changed, Janet?
No, not at all for me. I'm very hopeful and definitely looking to still pursue all of my personal goals career-wise, but you just have to stay positive. I know that times are really hard, but every moment of your life is an opportunity to get some kind of work, and that's how I looked at it. And where doors are closing, you're going to have to jam them open and create opportunities. And like for me, going to a temp agency was a way to create a new opportunity and make new connections.
Well, so, good luck to you, Janet. That's great advice. John Fox, have you changed completely your idea of what you're going to be doing in the next 2-3 years?
Yes, I have. Because when I my position came to an end, I had the next 3 or 4 years mapped out. That project was supposed to at least last that long. And then after that, I was going to take over the resort and kind of look after it. But now that everything's kind of the way it is, I'm trying just to look in a different area. But I keep my head up every day and stay positive and thank the Lord that he has provided me with food and shelter, and that's, you know, he provides our needs, not our wants. So,
well, John Fox, we are grateful you joined us this morning on the program. Dan Gross, there is the signs and those two voices of a shifting labor force, and it'll take years for that to shake out. Give us a last word.
Well, I think, you know, the experience of the two callers highlights what's going on around the country in terms of in different labor markets. We have a lot of parts of the country where things are very concentrated. You have banking or autos or real estate, which is the case in North Carolina.
And it's a lot more detail than the raw number from the Labor Department gives you. In about a half hour, we'll get that number for the month of March. Dan Gross, senior editor at Newsweek, columnist for Slate, thanks so much. Janet, join us from Harlem, and John from North Carolina, the Labor Force and Voices.
So we're doing a little experiment today on The Takeaway, and you are going to be in the experiment. Thank you very much. So all you have to do is tell us your name, where you are, and what you're doing.
Hi, my name is Kaki. I'm in Providence, Rhode Island, and I'm sitting in the kitchen before everybody else wakes up.
Hello, my name is Lucas Kaminsky, and I am in my clothes.
You'll find out why we're asking in just a little bit. In the meantime, tell us what you're doing, where you are, 877-8-MY-TAKE, 877-8-MY-TAKE.
You know where we are. We want to know where you are. Exploring the Takeaway community, 877-8-MY-TAKE.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. So all morning long, people in the Takeaway community have been calling 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org and updating their status. What are you doing? Where are you?
Hello, Karen Votava calling from Wakefield, Rhode Island, and am I the only person sitting at my computer this morning reading my email?
Hi, my name is Larry. I'm currently manning a toll booth at Exit 9 on a New Jersey turnpike. I'm the man nobody likes to see.
Oh, that is perfect. So update your status on our website. There are badges. There are points for checking in. It'll be completely awesome, all right? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Where are you? What are you doing? Femi?
Going to Kabul in Afghanistan next. A group of aid agencies in Afghanistan say they are worried, not because of the Taliban and those seeking to disrupt the work of aid agencies on the ground, but in a report out today, their concern is actually focused on the surge in American and other Western forces in Afghanistan and what that will mean for the local Afghan population. Matt Waldman is head of policy at Oxfam International, and he joins me from the BBC studio in Kabul. Matt, President Obama has committed 21,000 more troops to Afghanistan, and at NATO meetings today, other NATO countries may well be sending more forces. Why do you see that as a threat to civilians in Afghanistan?
Well, if I could just say to begin with that, I mean, we are very concerned about the conduct of militant groups that is jeopardizing the safety of civilians in Afghanistan. But this particular report was designed to coincide with the NATO conference and was focusing on the activities of international military forces. Now, what we have seen over the last few years in Afghanistan is a substantial increase in the number of international forces, but at the same time, we've seen an increase in the number of civilian casualties that are caused by those forces. And in fact, the number rose between 2007 and 8 by 30%, and the number killed in airstrikes rose by 70%. So, you know, that is a source of great concern to us, as well as raids, which often take place at night by international forces in the south and southeast of the country, which very often involve, you know, harm to civilians. We want everything possible to be done to minimize that harm to civilians in these military operations.
The report is called Caught in Conflict. What are you asking NATO forces, US forces to change regarding their behavior in Afghanistan?
Well, there are a number of things. The first point is what I just mentioned, that in operations, really the protection of civilians has to be a priority, and we want to see everything possible done to reduce that harm which has been caused civilians and their property. But also, we would like to see less aid being used by the military. We think that what happens is that it is tended to be distorted in order to achieve military objectives, whereas, of course, aid should be used to address the needs of the people. That's why it's delivered. And so we're concerned that, we welcome increased support for civilian sectors, but we're concerned that some of that support may be going through what are called provincial reconstruction teams, which are dominated by the military, and therefore that aid, that support may be distorted for military purposes. And we don't think it's as effective in promoting development when it's delivered in that way. And finally, if I may, I would just say that another point we're calling for here is for when harm has been caused by civilian by international military forces. Very often there isn't the fast response, investigation and compensation that there should be, and that really is critical. So we're calling for a new system to make sure that where harm does occur, then the appropriate redress is provided.
Matt, often the military quote their humanitarian work as some of the finest work they do in war zones. So how are you going to encourage them not to maybe work so closely with the local communities and actually get out of that business and leave it to aid groups?
Well, actually, if you look at international agreements that in fact were made in New York at the United Nations on this issue, it has been agreed by the United States and other major countries that where the military are involved in situations like this, they should only deliver humanitarian assistance as a last resort where there are no civilian actors capable of doing that. And so actually that's been agreed by the governments of the world, and in fact it's reflected here in some local arrangements and guidelines which have been agreed here.
Well, Matt, hold on 1 second, though. Are you calling for a return to the situation where humanitarian aid was typically decoupled from the military and delivered by organizations like USAID under the State Department? USAID hasn't had much funding or credibility for quite some time. Do you think a restoration of that infrastructure would help here?
Well, we certainly believe that USAID has a large role to play in the provision of humanitarian assistance. And actually, we're looking for the transformation of that department to be able to increase its capability to engage in this work. And I would say, yes, we are looking for the military to reduce substantially the amount of assistance that they provide for winning hearts and minds. And of course, that is a very different objective from the objectives of civilian agencies like NGOs, but also of USAID, which I hope would be to provide assistance to the people that actually addresses their needs.
Matt, I'm just going to have to wrap up here, but can I ask you just a very quick question? The President Barack Obama is to present his new Afghan strategy to NATO allies later on today. Do you expect a different way of working in Afghanistan now with a new administration in the US?
Well, we do, of course, hope there will be a coordinated response to the problems here. We need to see substantial improvements in the delivery of international aid. But we shouldn't forget that in 2006, the international community said it would rebuild this country and provide services to the people of Afghanistan. And those promises do need to be fulfilled. This is not only about security and military objectives. This is also about the Afghan people and providing a better life for them.
Matt Waldman, Head of Policy at Oxfam International in Afghanistan, thanks for joining us. Time now for some news headlines with Mark Garrison.
Thank you, Femi. Close to 29 minutes after the hour, we were just talking about Afghanistan, a hot topic today and tomorrow at the NATO meeting in France and Germany. French President Nicolas Sarkozy just said his country will accept a prisoner from Guantanamo Bay if that would help America close the prison. Right now, President Obama is speaking to a packed town hall meeting in Strasbourg. Later, he meets with German Chancellor Angela Merkel on the other side of the Rhine. Earlier today, President Obama spoke out about North Korea's expected long-range missile test.
Their missile launch is provocative. It puts enormous strains on the six-party talks, and that they should stop the launch.
All signs point to the North being ready to fire as early as tomorrow. North Korea says it's launching a satellite, not testing a weapon. But American intelligence, as well as South Korea's, does not buy that explanation. Femi.
Thank you very much, Mark. We are asking you where you are and what you're doing this morning. 1-877-8-MY-TAKE. All will be revealed in a moment.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of auto insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. We're making a detailed portrait of who we all are here, and who we all are here in the Takeaway community. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Tell us your name, where you are exactly, and what you're doing exactly. Be as specific as possible. Kitchen, car, workplace, mundane, insane.
This is David from the Bronx, and I'm just waiting for the coffee to finish.
Hi, my name is Gretchen. I'm in South Boston, Massachusetts, merging onto 93 North on my way to work.
I'm Mindy from Brooklyn, and I am getting ready to go to the gym. Woohoo!
Gym, kitchen, and car. Who's going to win in this takeaway community contest? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. That's great.
Let's keep the sporty theme going. It's April, but March Madness still lives on.
Twice, streaking down court to score, plus one.
Up ahead, Ellington. And just like that, basket counts. Heading to the line, North Carolina opens it back up again.
Here comes a Big Ten player of the year, spinning in traffic, leaning up, counted on the foul!
It's been a great tournament so far. The Final Four in men's college basketball is on Saturday in Detroit, Michigan. The Connecticut Huskies face the hometown Michigan State Spartans to kick it off. And following that will be North Carolina taking on the Villanova Wildcats. Now, here to tell us more about what we have to look forward to at the weekend, men's and women's, we have the sports blogger Ibrahim Abdul-Martin. Ibrahim, let's start with the men's games. So a nail-biting tournament so far, lots of upsets. What is it that you're looking forward to most in this Final Four?
Well, good morning. And I think, first of all, UNC is a scoring machine. Yeah. It's going to be a fast-paced game.
Villanova,
yeah, it's going to be exciting. I think the defense is going to be really key. And I think what you're going to actually see is actually a tighter game than what has come up before. In the Connecticut-Michigan State game, it's going to be a classic, gritty, tough, vicious contest between two really big guys. And, of course, the whole backdrop of the car industry and the demise of Detroit is going to be...
Michigan State, that's America's team, okay? UConn, that's the hedge fund manager's team, okay? That's my view. That's my view of the whole thing. It's got to be Michigan State.
See, Ibrahim, John has got this whole set up about what this team represents and what this team represents. So give us a rundown about who's in the Final Four for the guys, first of all.
So basically what you have is you have UConn, which is... UConn was number one for most of the season. They have this big guy, Hashim Thabeet. He's a brute. He's big. He rebounds. He blocks shots. He's the best shot blocker in the country.
Possibly best coach team in the country, too, UConn.
That's definitely arguable as well, because Michigan State has actually Coach Izzo, and some people think that he is the best person to coach this particular team and that they are on a run, particularly with the group of guys that they have right now. So I think Michigan State also, they have the Big Ten Player of the Year. UConn has the Big East Player of the Year. So if you want to talk about conference and regional rivalries, this is the game right here. This is going to be the larger-than-life game. I'm a Big East guy myself, but this is the larger-than-life game.
See, John was setting the table for me this morning. He's like, listen, Femi, cricket lover, this team means this.
She's doing all right. She's always running herself down, but I think
this
she's
team
doing
means this. Do it for our listeners.
Yeah,
John.
Well, you know, the Villanova. Let's start. I mean, you're a Big East fan. Villanova being in there is a good thing for you, right?
Well, it's massive. I think Villanova. You know, everyone starts to talk about 1985, but this is 2009, and I think this team has the most spread out team. They play really tough defense, and there's no big star on the Villanova team. So if you want to talk about the future team of America, that's Villanova.
Interesting.
What about your dream matchup for the final for the guys before we go onto the women's?
I personally really want to see the UConn North Carolina game. I think that would be an unbelievable matchup. And if you're talking about just pure basketball, I think that's the matchup.
You may be right, but Michigan State.
In Detroit, of course. Yeah, definitely.
Okay. And on Sunday, women's Final Four.
Yes.
What do we need to look for there?
Well, listen, you have undefeated UConn, the women's
undefeated
team,
does not describe UConn's heavily favored status this year.
They haven't lost a game by they haven't won a game by less than 31 points.
that's
UConn. So UConn's Monster. Exciting. Courtney Paris, the daughter of Bubba Paris, three-time Super Bowl champion, Courtney Paris of Oklahoma, has guaranteed victory. She's in the Final Four. She's a senior. She's unstoppable. She's a force of nature. Oklahoma, for me, it would be the best matchup. It's Oklahoma versus UConn. That might rival the men's game for larger than life.
I agree with you there. And if she pulls that off against UConn, it would be a total blow. It would be a mushroom cloud there in Detroit. Unbelievable.
So, Ibrahim, you sound pretty good here, but what's your bracket doing so far?
Well, if I had the Obama bracket, right? No, then my bracket is actually pretty poor because I'm a I falter because I love Syracuse so much, and they won the Big East.
They
almost won the
hearts.
Big East.
Yeah.
But I actually thought that Louisville was going to get it to the final game, and they didn't make it this far. The funny thing is that you have to factor in the Obama factor. Obama worked out with North Carolina. And you wonder, is that going to help them win?
Yeah, UNC is Obama's choice.
Exactly.
But here in the office, our pal Maxie, who picked Michigan State, is like at the top of the list because he like got tons of points.
I don't think anyone I know picked Michigan State. So yeah. I think if someone picked them, then they're definitely going to win the whatever the poll
definitely
is.
Definitely. It's a great, exciting tournament.
And this is America's tournament. That's the key thing. This is $600 million. CBS is making $1 million per ad. So it's almost bigger than the Super Bowl.
I know you listen every week, Ibrahim, to the show. So what is your takeaway for Final Four for Saturday and Sunday?
The future of college basketball is now, and you can watch it this weekend. The future of basketball, period, is now. You can watch it this weekend. Dynamic players, you have a multicultural game, and you have the upcome of some of the most exciting stars that you'll see in the future.
Ibrahim Abdul-Martin, sports blogger, thanks for joining us on The Takeaway.
He didn't do a prediction. You know,
he's very good.
A smart guy.
Very clever.
He's a very smart
you're,
guy.
You're going to enjoy it, he says. Yes. Time now for some news from Mark Garrison. Mark.
Thank you, Femi. 21 minutes before the hour. The latest unemployment rate just came out a few minutes ago, and the news is as grim as expected. 8.5% of Americans were out of work in March. That is the highest rate since 1983. That's nearly a half a point jump from the previous month. We can see how markets react in next hour.
They're loving it. They're loving it. The futures are up.
Futures are up.
It's like
okay.
A rally. So thanks, Wall Street, for all the help.
I don't know, sympathy for workers. Afghanistan will top the agenda at the NATO summit kicking off in France and Germany. President Obama is already in Strasbourg, France. He met with French President Nicolas Sarkozy this morning and praised France for their cooperation in Afghanistan.
France recognizes that having al-Qaeda operate safe havens that can be used to launch attacks is a threat not just to the United States, but to Europe.
Next, the president will go to Germany to meet with Chancellor Angela Merkel. The U.S. wants more help for the effort in Afghanistan from NATO allies. The president will talk with all of them in joint NATO events today and tomorrow. At the same time, several leading aid agencies are calling on NATO members to do more to protect civilians in Afghanistan. They say sending in additional troops could mean even more civilian casualties. Last year, more than 2,000 civilians were killed in Afghanistan. We talked to an Oxfam leader earlier in this hour. If you missed that, check it out at thetakeaway.org. Former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich has now been indicted on 19 corruption counts. The indictment says he tried to sell President Obama's Senate seat for personal gain. Blagojevich says he is innocent. John and Femi.
We're looking at the crowd in France. That Senate seat is worth a lot. It's great. Thank you, Mark.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Femi Okay.
So George Parker joins us now. He's a political editor of the Financial Times. The G20 summit ended yesterday. Barack Obama has gone off to the NATO summit there in Europe. George, what do you think the political, sort of outcome, takeaway is from this summit? There was disagreement over the notion of stimulus and regulation, but there was certainly a good deal of consensus as well.
I think that's right. I mean, there was a lot of pre-summit hype around the divisions on this, and it's certainly true there was a big division of opinion between Barack Obama on one side, who wanted the world to join him on a big program of fiscal stimulus, and the continental Europeans led by the French and the Germans who didn't. And in the end, that crack, that was probably the biggest crack of all, was papered over. And in the communique, there was a sort of ridiculous figure that they came up with, which said that the world was already halfway through a $5 trillion fiscal stimulus anyway, so not to worry about that. But I think the important thing is there was a great deal of consensus. You know, I think it's very easy to be cynical about these events and to go through some of the numbers. And some of the numbers in the communique, frankly, didn't really stand up to much scrutiny. But I think the important thing is you've got 20 leaders together. And we know very well from the last time the world went into a recession in 1933, there was a similar conference in London. President Roosevelt didn't turn up. The world went different ways. Protectionism set in. and the recession lasted much longer than it would have done. So I think, you know, overall, I think we have to say it's been a good thing.
Well, George, you know, we were reminded this week by James Sirwicki of The New Yorker that, you know, European nations, because they have a stronger welfare state and a lot more sort of money in government programs, actually are in a sort of stimulus posture more or less all the time. And so this disagreement maybe is less significant economically than it might seem. Let's shift to politics. What's it like to have a Barack Obama, the most popular leader in the world, maybe after Lula of Brazil, you know, getting so much credibility and so much attention, even as the U.S. is really at the root of the cause of all of these economic problems?
Well, I mean, Barack Obama, it's certainly true, has cut a sway through London. We have a picture on the front page of our paper today with everyone trying to get their arms around him to get a picture taken with him. These are world leaders, you know. So it's been a great show. I mean, we know that he's a good politician. At the summit, he showed his diplomatic skills in defusing what could have been a potentially nasty little row between France and China over tax havens, and his aides let it be known that he sorted that out. So, you know, it's true that, you know, he came over and said he was in listening mode. He wasn't coming to Europe to lecture, and I think that played very well.
Quickly, what about the U.S.-China relationship? That was like the big, big headline coming in. And how was that observed by all the other world leaders?
Well, I think you know, Barack Obama worked very hard on the Chinese relationship. I think China have been shown a path towards a much greater say in the International Monetary Fund. And I think lots of people are seeing this as the moment when China fully entered the world stage as a very important player. And some of the newspapers in the UK today are talking about the sort of creation of a G2 within the G20, the US and China. So I think that's played out very well. But you mentioned, you know, were people blaming the Americans for this crisis? Well, in domestic public opinion, of course, they are, and in national parliaments, of course, they do that all the time. Gordon Brown can hardly start a sentence without saying this crisis started in America.
But although
as soon as Mr. Obama turns up in town, of course, that's all toned down completely.
Although not a flying shoe in sight. You know, Obama has enormous credibility, even in this mode where people are inclined to blame the Americans. Well, I guess, you know, we'll leave it there at this point, but the politics shifts over to NATO. George Parker, political editor of the Financial Times, covering the G20 summit. Barack Obama now at the NATO summit, also in Europe. Thank you, George.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Femi Okay, sitting in for Adora Udoji. She's off with her gorgeous little baby girl. And sitting in for me while I'm doing that, sitting in, is Mark Garrison. Mark.
Nice to have you with us. It's 12 minutes before the hour. So, yeah. President Obama is in France right now, where he met with French President Nicolas Sarkozy. Both leaders are there for the NATO summit kicking off. Afghanistan is a major topic, but so is Russia. Here's President Obama on that a few minutes ago.
It is important for NATO allies to engage Russia and to recognize that they have legitimate interests. In some cases, we've got common interests, but we also have some core disagreements.
President Obama met with Russian President Dmitry Medvedev earlier this week. They say the countries are ready for new nuclear arms reduction talks. Protesters are demonstrating in France and Germany for NATO with lots of cops along with them. And I'll go back to John and Femi.
Thank you, Mark. So we want you to update your status here in the Takeaway community. We want you to tell us your name, where you are, and what you're doing right now. Our friend Scott Lamb will be here in just a few minutes to tell us why. But I wonder if you got to the studios at WNYC, okay?
Hi, Takeaway. This is Scott calling from Brooklyn. I'm just getting in my cab and realizing that it's raining outside, but I'm headed towards the studio now. I am checking in from the lobby of the WNYC building. My car made it here without incident. I'm checking in from the green room of the WNYC studios and drinking coffee to try and stay awake.
Well, I guess Scott made it. What are you doing? Update your status. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE and tell us specifically what it is you're doing, or you can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. And what are we doing this morning? Well, we're finding out about the virtual community called the Takeaway listeners and staff, and we've been asking you to call us because you know exactly where we are, but we don't know where you are. I mean, are you in the bedroom, the car, the kitchen?
Hello, my name is Keith Heron in Manhattan. I'm in my car driving around looking for a parking place.
I'm Michael calling from Bloomfield, New Jersey. I'm in my kitchen getting ready for my day.
Hi, my name is Gail, and I'm in the bathroom.
So who's more responsive, kitchen, bathroom, or car, folks? The data is available to us all of a sudden because you're calling in, you're updating your status. Scott Lamb, senior editor at BuzzFeed, first of all, thanks for joining us.
I'm happy to be here.
Thanks for participating in our experiment by calling in this morning. But what we're trying to do here is emulate a system that exists, or a number of systems that exist, like Twitter and one called Foursquare that we're going to talk about in a moment, where communities of individuals can monitor each other in terms of where they are and what they are doing based on very simple gestures on a cell phone.
Yeah, it's a great way of getting to know a community of people that you wouldn't really know what they're up to otherwise.
Now, if you're on Facebook, everybody knows what social networking is all about because of Facebook and MySpace. If you're on your Facebook page, that's pretty much what you're doing. You're on your Facebook page. The advantage with cell phone applications is that you can actually be doing something when you tell people what you're doing, other than just, I'm sitting here in front of my computer, right?
There's that. There's also, I mean, you do have to be somewhere out in the world to check in with these services. They use some combination of GPS or cell phone towers to locate you. So you have to be somewhere. You have to be doing something. And it's kind of nice that there's that built-in aspect to it.
All right. So everyone, of course, is shrieking, you know, so what is the point of this? What is the point of having a community where you check in? What does it begin to constitute as you see it online and also in the decisions that you make in your own life?
I think there's two things going on. I mean, one, there's a nice game aspect to it, which we can certainly talk about. But there's also, you get a sense of someone's day, what their life is actually like, a lot more vividly by seeing what they're doing than what they're talking about, what they're going to do, or how they describe what they might be thinking about. It's a different picture of a person.
And is this something that would give you ideas about what you might do? Or, hey, my friends are over here at this location. I think I'll go join them.
You can meet up with people. You can share tips. I mean, if you're at a bar and you're like, wow, I just had this great drink that only this bar has, you can actually add that into the system. And the next time a friend goes there, they can order the same thing. You can kind of pass on tips like that.
Now, you know, people, word of mouth is a very powerful tool. But as this scales up, how does it not just become marketing, where basically everybody on there is going to be some sort of marketing rep sitting in a bar going, all right, let's get this drink out because we want to, you know, promote this rum or something?
I mean, there's always the potential for that sort of abuse with systems like this. I think that they're kind of self-regulating, though. People get very irritated by that sort of thing. And I think as we find ourselves using things like Twitter and Facebook more often, I think people's sensitivity to that sort of use is going to really be heightened. I think a marketer would really be facing a backlash if they were going to try something like that, I think.
Scott Lamb, how has Twitter changed the game of social networking?
It's certainly lowered the bar, I think, for interaction. I mean, the amount of work that you have to do to kind of interact with someone on Twitter is very low. I mean, there's really no rules. You can just say one word and that can be a tweet. So I think it's made it a lot easier for people to figure out how to interact with one another in a social networking space.
You know, I like Twitter. A tweet, I think, is creepy. Facebook, I think, is creepy. Femi, help me here, because I've always thought Facebook was a little like, it's too much information, I don't want to know. But Twitter actually works for me. It seems intuitive.
The thing about Facebook, and because the team have been harassing me for the last year about getting a Facebook page, is I just feel like it's a little bit like stalking. But you can link into a friend's Facebook, and then you can link into theirs and theirs and theirs and theirs, and then you've got a whole, well, this is the good thing if you want it, you've got a whole community out there that you can actually dip into. But I actually linked up with Scott to be a friend yesterday, and he messaged me about 8 times, and he's at Freddy's, and then he's gone back to Freddy's, and he's at WNYC Radio just a few moments ago. So Is there a limit to how much information you can actually take on board at one time, Scott?
I think there definitely is. I mean, I imagine for you, since we have only just now met, that was kind of creepy to know that I was going out to bars in Brooklyn last night. I think that there is. I think people do need to be a little bit careful about how quickly they kind of expand their circle of friends. And you really, it depends on your level of comfort with the information that you're sharing and with what you want to take in. You need to kind of watch that.
Now, there are these sort of sexually based communities where there are very intense drivers of people joining and that sort of thing, and has had, you know, really dire consequences that have already made it into the news. In this particular case, Foursquare, the application we're talking about today, and Twitter to a certain extent, people sort of monitor what they're doing, and they give each other awards and badges, and explain how checking in a lot or shouting out to your friends can actually increase your status in the community.
They've added this nice game feature to it. So every time you check in, you get a certain number of points, and there are behaviors that you might not know about that unlock these badges. So, you know, if you go above 59th Street, I think you can and check in Manhattan, you can get a badge that basically says you're like a real traveler. You've gone above and beyond the call of duty to go and explore some new part of the city. So there's a nice feedback loop. There's also, you can become a mayor of a place. I think Jim Colgan is actually mayor of WNYC.
He's one of our producers.
And he if you check in a number of times at the same location, you can get awarded this mayoral status, which is kind of cool.
You have got a ton of badges. Does that make you a high user? Does it make you a geek? Would you be the equivalent of like a girl guide with a ton of badges up your sleeve? How would you define yourself, Scott?
I think I'm definitely a geek. You know, and since professionally,
it's so banal. Geek is so like last decade. You know,
excuse me, geek.
Yeah, right. Exactly. here on our site, though, I mean, our listeners are suddenly identifying themselves, and our top locations for takeaway listeners are cars. Gym, coffee, bed, bathroom, parking, lunches, on the train, driving, and listening to the takeaway. So we don't have the order on that, but it's suddenly if you know about your community, it's sort of intriguing. It's kind of intuitively intriguing in some way. Why?
I mean, it's difficult to pin down what that is. I felt the same thing with Twitter when I was trying to explain people how Twitter is, what it is that people use it for. There's just something inherently intriguing about it. You kind of want to know these things about people.
It makes your community more real. It's an engine for word of mouth. Very real. You can see it on Foursquare, the application I have on my iPhone. Twitter is actually a way to do this as well. Scott Lamb, thanks for helping us. Scott Lamb is the senior editor at BuzzFeed right here in our studio.
So as you've been hearing, we are doing a little experiment. So all you have to
do... It's a big experiment now.
It's growing by the minute. Tell us your name, where you are, what are you doing?
This is Amy from Boston. I'm just listening to the takeaway in the shower, and I'm slowly waking up after a long night on Facebook. I'm afraid I'm addicted.
Hello, this is Sue. I'm in my car driving to work in New Jersey and breaking the law by talking to you.
Good morning, all. 877-8-MY-TAKE. Go to our website, thetakeaway.org, where we will be giving you points for how many times you call and the weirdness of what you're doing.
Whether you're breaking the law or not.
There'll be a leaderboard online. We'll be giving out badges. See if you can get more badges than Scott.
Ooh.
Oh, thank you.
Break the law.
Thetakeaway.org is the place you need to go. And unemployment numbers have jumped to 8.5%, the highest since the late 1983. And so here's what one of you is actually doing.
Hi, my name is Kim. I'm calling from Brooklyn. I am about to sign on to the internet and start looking for jobs. And I'm wondering where Janet's temp agency is, because I'm signed up with 5, and none of them have got me work anywhere nearly as quick as hers did. So, Janet, what agency was that?
Thanks, Janet. I'm Femi OK.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
We don't need no thinking podcast.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
The Commander-in-Chief fighting the Cold War?
It doesn't mean the state micromanaging. Excuse me. I've been fighting this all week.
I've got to sneeze. I've got to sneeze. I've got to sneeze.
If America catches a cold, the global economy faces pneumonia. Covering your mouth at an international summit meeting, not recommended. Obama, just take some G20 and call me in the morning on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Friday, April the 3rd. I'm Femi Okeh. Adora Udoji is away spending time with a new baby. Coming up this hour, we'll talk about the outcome of the G20 summit. We'll also get the latest on the talks between US and Mexican leaders that continue today. And we'll talk to the Ford CEO, Alan Mulally. Those stories coming up, but first, headlines.
Alan Mulally, that's a big story. The nation's unemployment rate jumped to 8.5% in March, the highest it's been since 1983. A net total of 663,000 jobs were lost last month. That's slightly higher than economists expected. Meanwhile, in France, President Obama says he's seeking a partnership with Europe, not a patronage.
I've come to Europe this week to renew our partnership, one in which America listens and learns from our friends and allies, but where our friends and allies bear their share of the burden.
That was just a few moments ago. Thousands of people gathered at a town hall meeting in Strasbourg, France. He's there for a two-day NATO summit. Femi?
And earlier, President Obama held a joint press conference with the French President Nicolas Sarkozy. France says that it will accept one prisoner from Guantanamo Bay prison camp if it would facilitate its closing. A little bit later, he'll go right across the border to Germany, where he meets with German Chancellor Angela Merkel. And here in the United States, the House and Senate both approved drafts of the president's 2010 budget. But that's just one step. Tougher battles are expected as lawmakers work out details. Former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich was in Disney World yesterday when he learned he'd been indicted on federal corruption charges. The current Illinois Governor, Pat Quinn, was in Chicago. He says the indictment is necessary in order to avoid future scandals.
There is a serious crisis of integrity in our government, and I think it's very, very important that we, the people, confront this crisis, enact the reforms that will solve the problems, and make sure that they never happen again.
The charges come 2 months after Blagojevich was impeached and removed from office.
Stock market rally may continue today. Dow Jones Industrial Average kicks off at 79.78. More on the unemployment numbers in just a moment. So, Femi,
yes,
check
John.
In with me, all right?
Yep, I'm here in the studio.
You're
good
part
morning.
Of the Takeaway community.
Yep.
Everyone needs to sort of Twitter us. Call 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. We're getting an update on the community of the Takeaway.
Hi, my name's Robin. I'm calling from Rochester, Michigan, and I'm in my car on a way to a seminar. Love your show.
Hi, this is Matt. I'm in Salt Lake City, Utah, and I listen to your show every day while delivering newspapers.
Been fighting this all week.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
The Labor Department have released some new unemployment numbers today. Jobless rate jumps to 8.5%. That's the highest since the late 1983. Payrolls dropped 663,000. So what do these numbers mean? Best person for us to ask is our friend Kelly Evans from the Wall Street Journal Economics. She's one of their reporters. Good morning, Kelly.
Good morning.
Great to have you on board. We have actually been asking all morning about where people are, what they're up to, for a little bit of an experiment that we've been doing. It'd be interesting to see how many people actually are not doing anything at all.
Hi, my name is Heather. I am currently in Lathrop Village, Michigan. I am in my car on my way to the part-time job I have while I'm collecting unemployment, trying to find a full-time job.
Hey, it's McPaul in
Montclair, New Jersey. I'm making breakfast for the kids who are about to go to school. Then I'm going to go back to bed because I don't have a job.
So, Kelly, we get a really good sense from our community of listeners here on the takeaway that people are having trouble finding work. So what do these numbers actually mean, these new numbers mean, as far as the recession is concerned?
I think one thing they do is show people that as bad as the recession has felt over the last couple months, in fact, it's been that bad. We didn't just get a number for March, that decline of 600,000 jobs or so. We also saw revisions to previous months. And in fact, now it looks like January lost something like 750,000 jobs. So in the unemployment rate, jumped this most recent month to 8.5% from 8.1%. That was the highest since, in about 24 years. Now, I think what it does, the people will look at this and say, well, wait a minute. You know, we've been hearing a lot of talk in recent weeks about, green shoots of hope in the economy. And yet we get a report like this seems to suggest things are really, really bad. And they're not inconsistent, in fact. What this shows us is that, employment, these kinds of numbers are reflecting the pain that a lot of U.S. businesses are going through right now. We know corporate profits at the end of last year fell by, $250 billion as the credit market seized up and as consumer spending sort of dried up. And that has left companies scrambling to sort of help reduce costs any way they can, and most of their biggest cost is labor. So a lot of the layoff announcements we've heard in the last couple of months and a lot of this rise in unemployment is related to that, related to the fact that there are fewer and fewer job openings. It's not just the layoffs. It's that there are actually fewer positions now than there have been in the past.
Kelly, when we talked to you last week, you were talking about confidence. When will we actually see the numbers for unemployment figures actually going down rather than up?
That's a great question. That's certainly what we're looking to keep an eye on right now because, again, even if we're looking at early signs of stabilization in housing or retail sales, I mean, this report is much more reflecting the general state of the economy right now. And the early leading indicators in the report were not hopeful. If you look at the average length of the work week, it was fell down to a new record low, something like 33.2 hours. If you look at temporary employment, that was up, suggesting that more people that was down, so that suggesting that firms aren't even hiring temp workers ahead of a pickup in activity, that they're still shedding those people. If you look at the part-time unemployed, like your caller had mentioned, that has increased by another 500,000 to 9 million people who would prefer to be working full-time. The number of long-term unemployed is 3 million. The average length of unemployment is 20 weeks. It's almost long-term unemployed right now.
Now, we're looking at a couple of really interesting and quite frankly, negative structural trends going on here. You've kind of identified both of them. Let's focus on them for a moment. I mean, if the credit markets unfreeze, they're not going to come back to the way they used to be. So we're seeing structural changes in the way businesses do business, which is going to permanently affect the number of jobs in the U.S. economy. We're also seeing, and we've talked to some workers already this morning, who have completely changed the way they're viewing their own futures. They once self-identified as being in the construction market. Now they have no idea what they're going to do. It's going to take years for these two things to shake out, even if there's a turnaround in a small way tomorrow, right?
Absolutely. I think that's why a lot of the figures we're seeing in terms of how sharp the monthly layoffs have been and the total percentage of job losses, we're now going back to sort of the post-World War II adjustment that the U.S. economy went through, which in fact has some parallels to what's happening now. I mean, there's sort of this fundamental shift happening in the economy. And the interesting thing is that the only sector that continued to add jobs last month yet again was healthcare. Even government, state, and local jobs were lost as they go through some budget woes. It was across the board construction, manufacturing, professional services, all these retail jobs that, again, people used to sort of trade down into them when they were laid off, and now even those aren't available. So now we're seeing that a lot of people who had been employed there we're seeing rising poverty among that group. So again, I think what you're saying is exactly what a lot of households are frustrated by right now, which is that, well, great, sure there are some early signs of, maybe the end of declines in U.S. Economic growth, but it's not nearly the same thing as saying that the unemployment rate is about to recover. And certainly a lot of people see it hitting 10 or 11% over the next year, year and a half. It's definitely sort of a structural shift that we're going through.
So, Kelly, our 8.5% for unemployment figures nationwide in March actually equals 13.2 million people out of work. Some of our listeners are amongst that number.
Hi, my name is Lori Ludmer, and I'm calling from Teaneck, New Jersey, and I just drove my daughter to work, and I'm going to relax. I am unemployed.
Hello, this is Anne, and I'm sitting down to start looking for a job. That's what I'm doing.
So you talked about confidence last week, Kelly. If we were looking at perhaps the last recession and where the recession got to in terms of unemployment figures, where would we be? Could you actually compare a last recession with this recession and know where we are? Are we still at the bottom? Are we coming out of it?
Well, one interesting thing that's happened in the last two recessions, the 2001 recession and then the one in the early 1990s from 1990 to 1991, they were both relatively short, about 8 months, and what happened, though, is that unemployment and job losses continued after those recessions technically ended. So, you know, let's take the most recent one. The 2001 recession lasted from March to November of that year, while the unemployment rate continued to rise through mid-2003. That's why you heard a lot of talk about a jobless recovery. And that's why when we're talking about now, you know, a possibility that U.S. growth could turn positive later this year, it means that there could be several months, you know, perhaps years of trouble in the labor market. And when you get, you know, I've spoken with some economists about this, when you get unemployment near double digits, it's more of a structural sort of factor of the economy you have to work on, and it takes strong economic growth to bring those figures down. You know, it doesn't mean that if we creep along at a 2% growth pace, that's going to help bring that down. No, you need something like 5 to 6%. So there are plenty of challenges, and perhaps as consumer spending as consumers stay frugal, I think that government spending is going to probably drive a lot of sort of absorption in the labor market
For a while, Kelly. I mean, there are a lot of milestones out there. Listen to one of our listeners' milestones.
Hi, this is Francine. I'm in Brooklyn, and I'm enjoying the last month of my severance package, and I know that all will be well.
So severance packages going away, unemployment insurance going away, those are additional milestones that will have economic consequences as we look at these numbers in the next several 6-8 months.
Certainly, but I think the Obama administration is very attuned to the need to fund unemployment insurance and things like that. I mean, a lot of the states at this point have totally run out of their own and are borrowing from the federal government. So looking to support those programs, however possible, you know, as part of the debt or as part of the stimulus package that we've been hearing about. But, you know, again, if you look at the broadest measure of unemployment, in jargon we call this the U6 rate. It's found on Table 812 of the release. But basically it shows that the unemployment rate among people who are working part-time for economic reasons, people who are, you know, marginally attached to the labor force is 15.6% as of March. That's sort of the broadest gauge of U.S. unemployment. It's a very, very high number, and I think a lot of people, including the people who are calling in, absolutely feel that that's the case and feel a part of that figure.
So, Kelly, we lost 663,000 jobs. That loss happened, and those losses happened back in January. I know you're an economics reporter, not a forecaster, but what's ahead?
Well, interestingly, some of the indication we've seen this morning, and what my favorite was Chris Rupke, a Bank of Tokyo economist, who said this is the storm before the calm. Again, a lot of people have been expecting unemployment to hit double digits for quite some time. It's not new. I wouldn't say there's anything about this report that necessarily changes the outlook. Maybe it sort of gives people a better idea of how severe and how sharp this downturn is. But again, we sort of expect this trouble in the unemployment in the labor market to continue even if the U.S. economy starts to recover. So it doesn't really, you know, help out a lot of households or help out a lot of people necessarily, but it is sort of a fact that we've seen in the last couple of recessions. One thing that could sort of counter that this time around is that because consumer spending was such an important part of the downturn and because it's usually an important part of the recovery, you know, now there's less ability for people to use credit and debt to finance spending, certainly the way they have in the past. So income is more important than ever.
Thanks, Kelly.
Sorry.
Thank you. Kelly Evans, she's the Wall Street Journal economics reporter, crunching the numbers for the latest figures for unemployment out today. That's Kelly Evans from the Wall Street Journal.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
So we are doing an experiment today on the show, and we want you to help us out. You don't have to do much. All you have to do is tell us your name, where you are, and what you're doing.
Good morning. My name is Amy Berry. I'm from Rochester, Michigan, and I'm in my car commuting to Warren for my new job.
Hello, my name is Sylvia Scaglione, and I'm in my bedroom. I took a day off to celebrate my daughter's birthday.
And our friend Melissa Clark, she's the New York Times food writer, emailed us with what she's up to. Melissa says, "Hi there, everybody. I'm in my home office working, thinking about the Irish oatmeal simmering on the stove, listening for the first peeps of my five-month-old waking up. See you all soon." So call us 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Then you can go to our website where we're going to track where you are, because you know where we are. We'd like to know where you are.
Melissa, don't you know you have to stir that Irish oatmeal? Come on. You can't just like let it simmer on the stove. So good morning, everyone. At the G20 summit in London, they call it an agreement. But what does Barack Obama call it?
By any measure, the London summit was historic. It was historic because of the size and the scope of the challenges that we face and because of the timeliness and magnitude of our response.
Well, it will remain for world markets to sort out what the response was and whether it is sufficient. Barack Obama described it as necessary. Dan Price joins us once again. He was the former assistant to President George W. Bush on international economics and was also his representative in handling the G20 financial summit last November. Dan is currently a partner at the law firm Sidley Austin. He joins us from London. Something called the Washington Consensus came up. It was an idea that free market economics, something that the United States had a leadership role in, is maybe ended. Gordon Brown, the British Prime Minister, suggested that. Dan, thanks for coming back to the program and help us explain what's going on here.
Good morning.
First of all, what's your belief in this Washington Consensus? What's it all about, and has it really broken down?
Well, I'd say a couple of things. When people talk about the Washington Consensus, they refer to a body of opinion largely shared by the developed world in the post-war period in the middle of the last century as to what the key elements are for economic growth and prosperity. I don't exactly know why Prime Minister Brown chose to say that Washington consensus is over. It's got nothing to do, I don't think, with anything particular in Washington. But if you look at the declaration, you still see the affirmation of the importance of pushing back against protectionism and free trade. You still see the important recognition that regulation is essentially an exercise of national authority. Yes, by all means, it needs to be coordinated. There needs to be cooperation in doing our regulations. We need to avoid regulatory conflicts or regulatory protectionism. But there is nothing in the declaration, wisely, to suggest the substitution of a single global regulator.
Well, Dan, let me provide an alternative explanation for what Gordon Brown was saying. It seemed to me what he was saying is that thank goodness we're not being lectured to once again by the American GOP neocons. It seemed to me that's what he was saying. Now, inappropriate or not, it seems that that was a very deliberate statement on the part of the British Prime Minister.
I don't know. I mean, you'd have to ask him as to what he meant. But he was referring to really a historical concept. And frankly, I didn't interpret it, and I hope others didn't, as targeted to a particular administration or, frankly, a particular party.
If at a moment of more consensus or less American authority, you've got supreme authority and popularity on the part of Barack Obama, you know, that seems like a contradiction to me.
Well, there's no doubt about it. President Obama is a very popular figure globally, and frankly, deservedly so. But let's remember that the idea to include broadly representative nations at the global summit began last November. It was President Bush's idea to convene leaders to address the financial crisis that collectively represented more than 80% of global wealth and had a very strong voice from the developing world. That process continued and I think was enhanced at this summit, which I think was quite successful. And I think there were some very concrete deliverables coming out of this summit, including, importantly, the decision to enhance the resources of the IMF, and in particular, the commitment to enhance trade finance, to make credit available to get trade flows going.
Dan, this is Femi Oke here. President Obama is getting rave reviews for what he did at the G20. Any other world leaders actually getting a good bounce off the last couple of days? Gordon Brown from the UK was very highly visible.
Yes, I think this has been very positive for Prime Minister Brown. He and his team, I think, did an excellent job arranging this summit and negotiating a consensus text that, while importantly reaching consensus, did not lower the bar of ambition. So I think it was a successful summit for Prime Minister Brown. I think it was a successful summit for the U.S. administration. They came into this meeting with a very strong hand, having the week before proposed their own plans for strengthening the U.S. financial system, for dealing with impaired assets, and having laid out a broader regulatory reform agenda.
Give us a last word on the U.S.-China relationship. That was the big headline going in. Seemed a little quiet and muted coming out.
It's very strong, very important, and it's very clear you cannot solve global problems unless you have the U.S. and China in agreement.
Looks like agreement so far. Dan Price, former assistant to President Bush for economics and a partner with the law firm Sidley Austin. What does President Obama think about all this?
In life, there are no guarantees. In economics, there are no guarantees. The people who thought they could provide guarantees, many of them worked at AIG, and it didn't work out so well. So there are always risks involved.
Risks indeed. Economics tops the headlines with Mark Garrison.
Thank you. 29 minutes after the hour, we heard Obama talking about economics there. Afghanistan is also a hot topic. He's at the NATO summit right now. He's also speaking out about North Korea's expected long-range missile test. Earlier this morning, he said the world is against it.
It is not just us that has said that North Korea should not launch. Japan, Korea, Russia, China, the other members of the six-party talks have all indicated that this launch should not go forward.
The test could happen as early as tomorrow. The latest unemployment rate just out last hour, it's 8.5%. But if you add in underemployed part-time workers and workers who have given up looking, the actual rate is a full 15.6%. John and Femi.
You're a part-timer, right, Mark?
I'm pretty full-time right now.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of auto insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Introducing Edge, the all-new crossover from Ford. The Edge is never dull.
Living on the Edge, Edge is so 90s. But Ford's new product line is rolling out as the automaker is enjoying something of a dream moment. In the midst of a life-or-death crisis for General Motors and Chrysler and a near nationalization of those companies, Ford has been quietly going it alone. So far, it has said it doesn't need federal bailout money. But that doesn't mean Ford is absolutely a happy place financially. Last year, Ford reported its biggest ever annual loss, despite the sale of Jaguar and Land Rover. Now, it's in talks to sell off its Swedish subsidiary, Volvo. Joining us now is Alan Mulally. He's CEO of the Ford Motor Company. He joins me now from Ford headquarters in Dearborn, Michigan. Mr. Mulally, thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, you're welcome. Good morning to you, John.
And my first question to you is, you know, a lot of talk has been made of the fact that in many ways Ford's dodging the bullet here is not so much a matter of management as it is a matter of timing. And the fact that you had a reversal of fortunes about 2.5 years ago and arranged a credit line that has really been beneficial right now, is it more a matter of timing or more a matter of management savvy that's really gotten you to this point?
Well, that's kind of a tough question to ask. I clearly think that the financing is, important part of our business plan. But, John, what I'd go back to is the fundamental point of view that the Ford Motor Company has taken about the future going forward and the actions that we have taken to create that future. And 2.5 years ago, you know, we decided that the fuel efficiency was going to be very, very important to all of us going forward, along with quality and safety and good value. We also decided that we wanted to provide the customers an absolutely clear vision of Ford and focus on the Ford brand. As you mentioned, we divested Aston Martin and Jaguar and Land Rover and bought down our relationship in Mazda. And, of course, as you mentioned, we're looking at the next steps with Volvo. So the other thing we decided was we were going to be in every market segment that the customers wanted us in, small, medium, and large cars, utilities, and trucks. And we decided that every new vehicle that you got from Ford would be best in class in quality, fuel efficiency, safety, and value. And we have made tremendous progress on all 4 or 5 of those elements. And, of course, the piece that you mentioned is that we knew the economy was going to be slowing down. We wanted to continue this transformation during the worst of times. And so we took on some extra debt, and we have sufficient liquidity to make it through this and be there with the products that people really do want.
Well, a 41% decline in sales is the last reported number. So demand is going to have to pick up for you to avoid some of the similar difficulties that your colleagues at General Motors and Chrysler are experiencing in a very painful way right now. Last night, your colleague, Executive Chairman William Ford, told National Public Radio that the most positive news on the statistics front for Ford is the growing market share. That sounds a little bit to me like you might be happy to see Chrysler go away or a much smaller General Motors. Is that true?
Well, the most important thing is that we have and continue to produce the vehicles that people really do want. And we have really appreciated the fact that the customers love the new lineup, and we have increased market share over the last few months and quarters, and which is terrific.
But it's also conceivably a euphemism for it would be great if there was no more Chrysler. Do you believe that?
Well, we don't have a point of view about the competition. Clearly, the automobile industry worldwide is very, very competitive, and Ford is very well positioned not only in the United States but also in South America and Canada and Europe and Asia Pacific. And so, another part of our plan has been to leverage these fabulous Ford vehicles around the world, whether they're small, medium, and large, and bring that scale and that quality to all the markets around the world. So we feel like we're on a really good track.
Although I'm going to try this one more time, and then we've got listener questions for you. I mean, it conceivably, if Chrysler goes away and General Motors shrinks, it could look a lot more like Boeing, where you used to be an executive, where there's no competition really in the United States for commercial aircraft. You could be in a much less competitive situation here in the United States if those companies go away. That would be a good thing. Be familiar
to
you.
It'll be clearly, competitiveness is absolutely the key in business, and I feel very good about the actions that Ford has taken to continuously improve their competitiveness.
All right, one of our listeners from Eastchester, New York, has a question for you, Alan Mulally.
This is Mitch Weaver from Eastchester, New York. I'd like to ask Alan Mulally if he thinks it's possible to implement a gas tax that could support the sales of smaller, more efficient cars.
You know, many in Washington have talked about this as well, that a gas tax would actually help demand. Do you agree?
Well, clearly, getting the consumer involved in energy independence, energy security, sustainability is absolutely key, no matter what our how we come out on our energy policy going forward. And you could really see what happened as the fuel prices went up over this last year, and the consumers moved to a more balanced portfolio of small, medium, and large vehicles. So clearly, I think it's important one way or the other. I mean, gas tax is one way, but clearly that we get the consumer involved. I might point out that in Europe and many of the other areas around the world where they've had a integrated energy policy where the consumer has been paying the real cost of energy, that the average size vehicles are smaller. So I just think it's really important that we get the consumer involved in this policy going forward.
But does the demand for hybrids and fuel-efficient cars need a push in your view?
Well, absolutely, because it's a value proposition to us. We make an economic decision when we purchase a car, and the technology that we put into a hybrid, you know, it costs more, but also delivers better fuel efficiency. And so there's an economic case to be made, and clearly the more the fuel costs, the more beneficial the hybrids and the electric vehicles will be.
All right, quickly, here's a listener named Samuel with a very specific problem related to hybrids.
I recently bought a 2008 Mercury Mariner hybrid, but there were so few available, I had to wait for absolute weeks. Why aren't they making more of these hybrids so that people could buy them and so that the company could take advantage of a product that is timely?
CEO Mullally?
Oh, yes. Well, Samuel has a really good question, because we, when we first introduced the Escape and the Mariner hybrids, we were, you know, very pleasantly surprised at the demand that we had for those vehicles. And they are a small utility, so they have all of the advantages of a car, but all of the wonderful versatility of an SUV. And so great size, great fuel efficiency. And so we have now increased our production on those, as well as the new Escape. And
right, also, but there's I'm going to just jump in here for a second. I'm talking with Alan Mullally, CEO of the Ford Motor Company. We're talking about the infrastructure required for new kinds of efficient vehicles.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Femi Okay.
And I'm John Huckenberry. With me is Alan Mullally, CEO of the Ford Motor Company, on the line from Dearborn. Finish your thought about what Samuel was saying. It seems like there's an infrastructure that's required to support these new hybrid vehicles, and that's ramping up and has to ramp up over the next few years.
Oh, sure. I think Samuel's question, John, really was about the availability of being able to get the hybrid that he wanted. And he was absolutely right. When we first introduced the SUV, the small SUV utility hybrid, it was such a success in the marketplace. And we have been gearing up our production even more rapidly to satisfy that demand. And we really see that now also with the new Escape hybrid, and also the Fusion hybrid, which gets 41 miles to the gallon, 8 miles to the gallon better than the Toyota Camry. So we really learned from Samuel's question, and we are going to have the vehicles that people want in the quantity that they want them.
All right, Alan Mullally, here's a question from your neighborhood, close to your neighborhood anyway.
My name is Anthony Ambrogio. I live in Grosse Pointe, Michigan, just one block outside of Detroit. I wonder what the auto manufacturers can do about the people who sell and service their cars, because it's been my experience that even when an American manufacturer makes a superior product, the problem comes in with the people who sell the car and then are supposed to service it. They treat you like dirt.
Problem of branding and customer service there. How are you dealing with that?
Well, Anthony really makes a good point. And if you look a little deeper into Anthony's question, one of the issues that we ended up is that we ended up with too many dealers, especially in the large metropolitan areas. And so the most important thing that we're doing with the dealers in partnership with them is to get the dealers, the size of the number of dealers around the United States, get it right sized. That means they'll get their throughput up, their profitability up. They'll continue to invest more in their store, and their whole attitude and the way they approach the marketplace will improve dramatically. But I'm with Anthony that I think with the Ford brand now and also the quality of our vehicles and the excitement that the dealers have, especially as they become more successful as we get them right-sized, I think that everybody's going to have a whole different feeling and experience with Ford going forward that they're going to really appreciate.
Alan Mulally, we have time for one more question. Here it is.
Yes.
Good morning. Troy calling from North Dakota. Question for Alan Mulally. Individual production designs aside, how can American auto manufacturers innovate their processes or upgrade their facilities to close the production gap and come up to speed with their foreign-based competitors whose North American plants consistently outperform us?
Alan Mulally?
Well, absolutely. I'm glad you asked that question. It's a great ending question. That has been our number one goal, is that we are best in class with every new vehicle when it comes to quality, fuel efficiency, safety, and value, which means productivity. And I'm really pleased to be able to share with everybody that with the agreements that we've made with the UAW, that it's a transformational agreement on our cost structure, plus what we have done in the plants on quality and productivity, we are equal to or better than the best auto companies in the world when it comes to our quality and our productivity. But also, even so important to all of us, that means that we can make the finest cars in the world, small, medium, and large, in the United States, and do it profitably. So we're going to provide a lot of opportunities and a lot of excitement for so many people going forward.
Alan Mulally, CEO of the Ford Motor Company, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, John. Drive a Ford.
He's speaking to us from Dearborn, Michigan. That's Alan Mulally, the Chief Executive Officer of the Ford Motor Company. Hasn't taken TARP money yet. We shall see.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Friday, April the 3rd. Here are the big stories you need to get started in your day. Mark Garrison has them.
Thank you, Femi. 12 minutes before the hour, President Obama is en route to Germany. He'll be there and in France today for the NATO summit. This weekend, he'll be in the Czech Republic to lay out plans for reducing nukes.
The spread of nuclear weapons or the theft of nuclear material could lead to the extermination of any city on the planet. And this weekend in Prague, I will lay out an agenda to seek the goal of a world without nuclear weapons.
That's President Obama a few minutes ago at a packed town hall meeting in Strasbourg, France. He met with French President Nicolas Sarkozy. He meets next with German Chancellor Angela Merkel. Even though he's overseas, President Obama is notching something of a victory back in Washington. The House and Senate both approved his budget blueprint, but tougher battles are ahead as lawmakers work out details on White House priorities like health care, energy, and education. John and Femi.
So continuing it's become kind of a huge experiment today on The Takeaway. We want you to help us out. Update your status, okay? Be part of the Takeaway community at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Hi, this is AJ. I'm calling from outside Detroit, Michigan, and I'm driving to work to General Motors, and I'm very excited about all my seeds that have sprouted that I planted a week ago.
Man, he's way ahead of me. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Then go to our website where we're trying to track who you are, because you know where and who we are. We want to know more about you. Femi?
Thank you very much. Now, this is intriguing. Investor Warren Buffett's financial wizardry is a mix of shrewd analysis and steely self-control, which keeps his instincts in check when others may be losing their heads. Now, Buffett digs deep for rational behavior and uses self-correction to inform his decisions.
Yeah, but why is he a fatso then?
I'm getting to that in just a moment. According to a biography of Buffett, and he's not a fatso, he applies a similar rationale to moderating his weight, John. Behavioural economist Dan Ariely says that Buffett's weight program offers an example in self-control that's relevant to our economic times. Maybe Dan can help John. He joins us from Duke University. Where he
what are you saying?
Nothing. He is the James B. Duke Professor of Behavioural Economics. He's also the author of Predictably Irrational. So, Dan, if you're trying to lose weight, you're going to have some sort of self-control anyway. But what is particularly interesting to you about the way that Buffett has tried to lose weight?
So, first of all, it's very interesting that Buffett is very good in self-control in general. His main idea that you buy when other people are panicking and means that he has a long-term view of investment. He doesn't have to worry about the short-term view of getting panicked. He thinks about the long-term view. But nevertheless, despite his ability in financial thinking, when it comes to his own weight, he fails in self-control. He doesn't succeed in doing it. So what he did was he created a contract that would force himself to have self-control. And basically, he tempted his kids to control him. He wrote the $10,000 checks to his kid and said, if you catch me eating fatty food, I'll sign this check toward you.
Because so he didn't sign the checks?
He didn't sign the checks, but the checks were with his kids. And he said, the moment you catch me eating a donut or something, I will sign the check.
They tried really hard to tempt him.
That's right. That's the problem with this particular contract, that if you sign checks to your kids to do this, they will start leaving pizzas and donuts and things everywhere around. But despite that, he was successful in achieving this contract. And that's actually a high level of sophistication. Of course, this is what we would expect from him. Many people, everybody has self-control problems in different things. Most people don't understand their self-control problem. Some people understand their self-control problem and try to solve it. And what Buffett did was to create a mechanism that would get him to behave better even when he is tempted, because the fear or the unpleasantness of signing these checks for his kids was going to be too high to let him do that.
So Dan, why are you teaching your students about self-control? Why is that so relevant?
So self-control is really kind of at the heart of many problems that we have in life. If you think about it, why don't we save for the long term? It's the now versus later. Why don't we exercise? Why don't we do medical checks? Like imagine that we ask you whether you want to have a colonoscopy today, right? The chances are very low that you will feel like it's a good thing for today, but you would recognize that for the long term it's a good thing. And our continuous failure in many aspects of life of sacrificing the long term for the short term is the basic problem of self-control. So now we have this problem, we understand it permeates many aspects of our life. The question is, how do we solve it? How do we get better? And the Buffett approach, which is the self-control mechanism approach, is one approach to try and find a solution, to basically create a contract against ourselves that would get us to behave better.
So basically we have to have something that we're really terrified of losing, i.e. Buffett and lots of money, to actually keep us in control.
It can either be bad or good. I can tell you my own personal attempts with this. So many years ago when I was in hospital, I got a liver disease from blood transfusion, hepatitis C. And as a consequence, many years later, they discovered a medication for this, which was interferon. It was a terrible medication. I had to take an injection 3 times a week. And after each injection, I felt sick for about 18 hours, fever, shivering, vomiting. And the difficulty was, how do I inject myself with this injection 3 times a week for 1.5 years, when after each of those I'm going to be sick for such a long time? So I had the opposite. It was what was going to be something terrible in the short term that I wanted for the long term. And the question is, what do I do? How can I fight it? And in my particular situation, I like movies. I actually like movies a lot. I would watch a lot if I had time. So I tried to connect a good thing with the bad thing. So every day I would go in the morning to school, I would rent a couple of movies, I would think about them, and then when I would come home, I would inject myself, and then I would position myself next to the television, I would put a bucket for vomiting, I will set myself up for the fever and the shivering.
Just nice breakfast time.
What's a great movie when you have a bucket next to you, Dan?
Oh, you know, I did it for 1.5 years. I watched hundreds of movies. The good thing, I don't have that good memory anyway, so I could watch the same movies over and over. But the interesting thing was, it worked. From the whole protocol of this experimental drug, the doctors told me I was the only patient who took the medications regularly.
Let's draw a parallel between the situation that we're in right now. Can we draw a parallel between self-control and the economic downturn or the recession, Dan?
So self-control, again, is the issue of doing something for the short term, not for the long term. So I think investors' behaviors, when you think that you watch your portfolio, you see the market not doing well, and on the moment, on the emotional effect of the moment, you decide to make some dramatic changes to your portfolio, is something that is lack of self-control. If you tell yourself, I'm going to put another step between me and my decision, I'm going to have an advisor, I'm going to ask permission from my spouse, that would create another level of self-control. You can also think about some of the aspects that got us here, which is spending a lot of money, not saving for a rainy day and so on, as an indication of a failure of self-control. For a long time with credit cards and so on, it was very hard to give up the short-term reward of buying whatever we wanted for the long-term effect of having more money sometime in the future.
But interesting enough, people are giving up more of their credit cards, doing a little less spending now, so maybe it needs a really big fearful impact for people to be able to do that. What about if people had incredible self-control? What effect would that have on the economy? Would we be in this mess right now?
So we need more than great self-control to avoid this mess. There was also this issue with prices of housing and so on. But I think if we had more self-control, the type of consumer society that we have would have been much less intense. The amount of impulse purchases would have been lower. Decision would have been aimed much more at the long term than the short term. It could have also been that bankers and companies would have had a longer term horizon rather than trying to just maximize profits for the particular quarter. At the same time, you know, it would have been nice to have more self-control, but some of the beauty of the things we do is what we feel like at the spur of the moment. And I don't want people to become Mr. Spoke-like and think about everything always to the extreme, but we do need more of it. It doesn't mean that we want to be completely self-controlled.
Dan, thank you very much. One more question for you from John.
Well, I guess never put off a colonoscopy for tomorrow that you can have today. Is that the lesson for
right.
today here? But we were listening to Alan Mulally a moment ago.
Getting the consumer involved in energy independence, energy security, sustainability is absolutely key no matter how we come out on our energy policy going forward.
Now there, the Ford CEO is sounding very much like a CEO, but he hasn't taken any federal TARP money, federal bailout money. Is that a rational strategy, Dan Ariely, or irrational?
Well, I think right now it has enough money, and also the problem is that when auto manufacturers are taking bailout money, they have a change to their image and also to the expectations of how long they'll survive. So I think from that perspective, it's probably a good strategy.
Good strategy.
If you think about
a good review from Dan Ariely. Well, you know, we'll do that as a takeaway for Ford CEO Alan Mulally.
He'll be very happy to know.
Yes, he'll be very happy. Thanks, Dan. Dan Ariely from Duke University. So keep your updates coming. Call us. Tell us your name, where you are, and what you're doing. 877-8-MY-TAKE. And we had about 275 update responses to you. We're kind of emulating the world of Twitter and Foursquare. Go to our website, thetakeaway.org. We're giving you points and badges for your responses. Yes, you do. Badges. Yes. Bob gets the Eyes on the Road badge for calling while driving and then missing his exit and getting lost in the process. Paul gets the No Plaque Plaque for telling us that he just got back from the dentist. Oh, this is great stuff. A note for Jim Jim Colgan. Thanks for that.
I'm Femi Okay.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org, and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.